Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Is the water we drink as safe as it can be? Are rising nitrate levels in our waterways a bigger issue than we realize? Catherine Zeman is an environmental health researcher with Northern Iowa University. Thursday night at 7, Catherine will present Nitrates and Our Health. That's inside the Mickelson Auditorium on the campus of Augustana University in Sioux Falls. The lecture is free and open to the public. Catherine Zeman received a PhD in preventive medicine from the University of Iowa. She was a Fulbright scholar focused on environmental health issues, and she's contributed chapters to numerous books about public and environmental health. She's co-authored or authored more than 30 published articles about nitrates, environmental health, and other public health topics, and she joins us on the phone now. Catherine Zeman, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Lori.
I feel like we should start from the beginning and sort of make a definition of what nitrates exactly are. How do you explain that to people? What's a nitrate?
Well, nitrates are combinations of nitrogen and oxygen in, I guess you would say, electroactive combinations so that they interact as anions with our body. They're important substances to us, and they can also be concerning substances to us. So I think if you think of them as nitrogen-oxygen combinations that are important to life, but can also be a concern depending on the amount that we encounter.
So when we talk about nitrates in our water, is that synthetic? Or are they occurring naturally or both?
Both. So generally, the natural environment, about 140 teragrams per year, right? From natural sources, from leguminous plants, a little bit from lightning in the atmosphere and things like that, that would end up on the ground and then be in a water-soluble form. It's essential for the production of proteins and some of the important activities in our body. But what has happened, because humans recognize that those nitrates were a limiting factor for the growth of plants, and because of just some of our animal husbandry activities, et cetera, and the way things can leak into surface bodies of water and then get in groundwater, we began polluting and or fixing intentionally nitrate, you know, into the water courses around our cities. And we now kind of drive the nitrogen cycle that way. I mean, it's over 200 teragrams, which, to put that in perspective, is 2.2 times 10 to the 8 tons per year, fixed and driven by humanity. So we end up getting a great deal of nitrate, and then nitrite, as it's converted, most often we end up ingesting the nitrate, which is NO3. It's an anion, negative anion. And then that's converted by bacteria in our gut to NO2, nitrite. And the nitrite is very biophysically active in our bodies. So it can become an issue. We need a little bit of it. It's helpful in our bodies. It's helpful for plant growth. And then we end up getting a lot more than what we need. And we call those substances hormetic substances. They follow a hormesis curve of toxicity. So it's kind of like a smiley face, right? A little bit is good. And then you have this happy medium. And then when you get to the other side of that smiley face, right, and you get too much, you have a problem. So,
all right, I want to talk about what it does to our bodies in a little bit, but let's start with, where is it coming from and how is it getting into our waterways? You've alluded to it here, but let's break down exactly what's happening.
Okay. Well, now, again, I'm a specialist in environmental health, but I do know a bit about where it's coming from. Usually it's from our farming activities, but it depends on your location. I mean, people in urban areas apply a lot of fertilizer to their yards also, and you can have excess runoff from that. But we have this tendency to do tiling in important agricultural areas that, you know, may be done without regard for setbacks from the tiling areas. You know, they're set in there to drain the water. And we end up with a lot of runoff directly off the fields that's not mitigated by setback buffers. Most of the time we found if people do setback, cover cropping, intercropping, you can readily control the amount of nitrate that really ends up in these tiling conduits, but that is not always done. So we see a lot of excess nitrate coming off agricultural fields. It can also come in a situation where people might be having a private well, and then they have a septic system near that well, and they're not taking care of that septic system properly. They're going to end up with a lot of E. coli and nitrate in their septic system. So there's multiple places. Certainly, if you look at the biggest amount of runoff, it's coming from our agricultural activities. And that's generally how we're experiencing it.
All right. So are we ingesting it by drinking water? How is it getting into our bodies to do
okay.
what it starts?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, there's a couple of sources of nitrate. One is vegetables in the diet, and the other is drinking water. And it's important to keep in mind that those sources, although they're both ingestion sources, they have different characteristics. In other words, when you ingest vegetables, fruits and vegetables, they contain higher amounts of nitrate. And in fact, in the dietary intake, that's usually where we get the largest amounts. But those are in a complex mixture set off by antioxidants, phytonutrients, and other kinds of free radical, substances that tie up free radicals in our diet. When you're getting it in drinking water, you're getting it unopposed in a matrix of antioxidants. So usually the most concerning exposure is in our drinking water when it's unopposed by any of the vitamin C or other phytonutrients, antioxidants, et cetera, that could kind of help mitigate the impacts of this electronegative molecule.
And you said they are biophysically active. So tell us what that means. Because that sounds sort of ominous, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but some of it is good. Again, like I said, we need nitrogen in our bodies. And nitric oxide, nitrate, there's a relationship between nitrate, and nitric oxide in the body. That's been clearly demonstrated in anatomical, physiological studies. But ultimately, we use nitrate in the form of nitric oxide, and it's used to encourage the inflammatory response. It's used as a neurotransmitter. I mean, there are important uses for nitrogen and nitric oxides and nitrate and nitrate in the body. But we are in a situation where we are disrupting global nitrogen cycles, and at times we are getting a lot more, perhaps, than we need. So I think that it's, again, at that point on the toxicity benefit curve of hormesis, where we need a little bit, then we have a happy medium, and then at a certain point, and it's going to be a little bit dependent on your age, okay, obviously, and whether we're looking at the acute or chronic concerns with nitrate exposure, you're going to end up with, you know, a point where you're going to be getting too much. So
how much is too much?
Okay. Well, right now, the only regulatory level we have under the Safe Drinking Water Act for nitrate ingestion, the maximum contaminant level, is what it's called. It's kind of think of it as the, I heard it explained this way recently and I really liked it kind of think of it as a speed limit control, okay? So right. Once you get above this limit, it's a bad idea. It's 10 parts per million nitrate nitrogen. It's a level that was set for acute health impacts, so ingestion over short periods of time. And it was set to protect children from infantile methemoglobinemia. And that is a condition where you ingest too much nitrate. Because of the age of the individual, their children, there's a number of biophysical parameters in their body that aren't quite developed yet, and other things about their gut that make the nitrate readily move into a nitrite phase. And then that impacts the red blood cell. It will impact the red blood cell if you have enough of it for an adult too, but children around 1 year of age or less, maybe 1 to 2, depending on the child, are going to be impacted by levels above 10 parts per million nitrate nitrogen more detrimentally. And what it does is it changes, and I know there's a lot of complex following here, but biochemically, it interacts with and changes the hemoglobin molecule so that the red blood cells, which have hemoglobin in them that carry oxygen, cannot then carry oxygen. And that's the basic definition there of infantile methemoglobinemia.
Hmm.
which is a chemically acquired anemia. So the red blood cells are there, but they're just not working.
And how much do we know about the chronic impact of nitrates?
Well, that's an interesting area, and I've been looking at that more closely the last 8 years or so. And there's a plethora of studies out there that, you know, lead us to maybe be a little bit concerned about the chronic exposure levels, because when you really lay those studies out, and there's at least 30 of them now, looking at everything from arthritis to thyroid disease, I mean, a number of conditions. The exposure levels related to the chronic exposure concerns seem to be much lower than the acute disease condition, and that's the only one we have a current regulatory level for. So it's concerning, and I think that that is why individuals with the IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, et cetera, have, you know, released in the mid-2000s, it was around 2008, actually, a paper that looked at nitrate as a possible or probable human carcinogen. So it related with ingestion of water. So
how new is the research? I mean, how long have, well, I guess, you know, over time, you know, as agriculture changes, as, you know, urbanization occurs, you know, what have you, have we been seeing an increase in the usage and an increase of what ends up in the water in spite of regulatory controls? And then is the health impact research keeping up with the changes in the environmental, you know, what's in the environment itself? Do you see what I'm asking there?
Yes, I think those are two good questions. Okay, I think they're interrelated. So first, yes, there have been increasing levels in some areas, and certainly it depends on the water course in the river. But generally, there's been a trend towards increasing levels of nitrate in surface water supplies and certainly depending on the area and some of the groundwater supplies. So how does that associate with the literature and the kinds of studies? And I think that is another thing that concerns some of us in the areas of environmental health and public health. And that is that these studies on the health effects, chronic health effects, date back into the 1970s and stretch forward all the way into the current era. Seeing studies all the way up into the late 2000s here. And some of these studies have been particularly well done studies. They're, you know, getting a little bit into the area of the different kinds of study designs and epidemiology, et cetera. Right. But we have a range of study designs. Certainly, they have more correlational studies, but we also see studies that are cohort in nature, case control in nature, very well designed studies. I'm thinking of some of the studies by Wire and Ward and Bender. I mean, we're talking some very well-designed and well-done studies that look at everything from birth defects to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma to thyroid cancer and ovarian cancer.
The science is important to understand, even if it can be challenging to understand. But I think also people want to know, you know, what can I do? Or is this something that as we learn more about it, there are policy issues that need to be addressed? Are there personal, you know, consumer behaviors? You know, can you drink bottled water? Or, you know, those things that people would normally ask you, well, how do I avoid this as we figure out what's going on? Where do you want to start there? Policy? Okay. Is it time to change policies? Do we have enough science to say, you know, this is urgent? Let's start there.
Well, I think timing related to that is an important issue to discuss, and probably on the part of individuals who are more aligned with policy issues than me. I think timing is important for when you open up an issue like this. Yeah. And, you know, I think I would just leave that to maybe the politicians, et cetera, and people involved with environmental policy and lawyers and things like that would be involved with that. I would just say timing is important to consider, right?
Okay.
when you open up an issue like that. I think scientifically, the scientific community, we have continued to talk about this. We've been talking about this and continue not infrequently to have symposiums, conferences. There was just a large national symposium put together by the University of Iowa and people that worked with the Center for the Study of Environmental Contaminants and Their Health Effects down at the University of Iowa. This was just about a year and a half ago. So we continue to talk about this and look at this issue, and people continue to be concerned about it at multiple levels. I think one of the things that an individual can do, so outside of the political side of things and looking at the maximum contaminant levels, et cetera, and opening up that dialogue with EPA, individuals need to get to know their water supply. You know, it's amazing. Often talk to folks about the health concerns with drinking water quality, et cetera. And most of them are not really even knowing how to get the information that would allow them to understand what's in their drinking water. So they have to determine, am I on a public source of drinking water? Am I on a private well? If they're on a private well, then they're kind of like their own water provider. They have to manage that well and have it treated and know what's in it and apply for testing dollars if their local public health department offers that. I mean, here in Iowa, we have a grants to counties program, and many individuals can access yearly testing of their drinking water as long as the funds are available that year to have it tested, so they can know, you know, what is my nitrate level? What does the E. coli in my water look like? Are there other pesticides or metals I should know about? So you have to be aware of that. And then if you happen to be on public drinking water, the Safe Drinking Water Act requires community reporting every year. It's usually around mid to late June or early July when those reports are made available. And you should be able to contact your drinking water treatment facility and ask for that report. Look at what's in your water and look at how close, you know, the levels that they're monitoring are to the regulatory levels. They're MCLs, maximum contaminant levels, again. And then, like I said, that's kind of like the speed limit for what's in your water. How high can it go, right? And become familiar with what's in your water. If you see something that's a problem, then you need to think about how you personally want to handle it. And there's a number of ways that can be handled, everything from putting in your own drinking water treatment system in your home, not without its cost. I mean, it's probably around $1,300 to $2,000 to put a reverse osmosis treatment system in your home. That's the kind of system that will really remove nitrate. And that's kind of part of the issue that's been triggering a lot of discussion around the country, because when the nitrate levels exceed 10 parts per million consistently in a city area that has to report under the Safe Drinking Water Act, then that city has to take the same kind of action. It has to put in a massive tertiary treatment system to remove the nitrate. And then really the best way to do that is reverse osmosis, and then that increases the cost a lot. Another option for people is, you know, drinking water that's coming from maybe the big 5-gallon delivery jugs. I really tend to kind of discourage people with individual bottles for a number of environmental reasons, but
right.
Those are some of the options that are out there. I mean, if you try to remove the nitrate with just a simple carbon filter, like, you know, the kind of filters you can get associated with pitchers and
right.
maybe the thing you can just screw onto the faucet in your sink, it's not going to do the job for you. It won't remove the nitrate. If you try to boil it, it's not going to remove it either, because what it'll do is it'll concentrate the nitrate. In fact, if you're on high nitrate water and you have an infant in the home, that is a definite problem. You don't want to do that because it will concentrate the nitrate, and then the infant would be getting even more nitrate.
So can that really change? How quickly can that change? I mean, if you find from the Safe Water Drinking Act, you get those maximum contaminant levels from your water provider, assuming you're on a public system now, we're talking, you know what the yearly report is. Can all of a sudden, if there's some kind of industrial event, for example, can that impact your child and have an acute impact on their health of an infant? How fast can it happen?
Theoretically, if you're pulling drinking water out of surface water, and some cities and towns do rely on surface water, rivers, et cetera. And there were a massive spill or something like from a containment lagoon associated with some animal husbandry activity, something like that. Yeah, sure, there could be a serious spike. And that's an issue and concern. And usually under the Safe Drinking Water Act, if that's detected, the local utility, as long as you're on a local utility, would have to notify people right away of that concern. So they would want to be watching for that, and it could be an issue. But that's, again, theoretically speaking, it's going to depend on, you know, how much is spilled and how quickly the water is flowing in an area, you know, what the, you know, if it's coming from a reservoir, you know, how much is in the reservoir. So there's these kinds of issues to think about related to how much could end up in your drinking water at any point in time. And probably the most important thing to know is from year to year, what is your safe drinking water report look like for your community?
Right.
And if you're on your own private well, year to year, what do those numbers look like when you test your well for the levels of nitrate, E. coli, pesticides? And then how do you handle that? What's the best way to do that? You know, your local public health department often offers a great deal of assistance in that regard. They work with certified specialists who treat wells and who repair and upgrade and manage wells, private wells for people. So that's another resource for the individual so that they can manage their water quality and protect their health.
We've been talking with Dr. Catherine Zeman. She's an expert on matters related to nitrates and human health impacts. And you can hear her talk Thursday night at 7 at the Mickelson Auditorium on the campus of Augustana University. That program is sponsored by Friends of the Big Sioux River, who are active in looking at the nitrate pollution on the Big Sioux River as a problem that they believe should be acknowledged, addressed, and prevented. Catherine Zeman, we appreciate the science lesson and the information you've provided today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it.